In the leafy green fields of the nation's salad bowl, growers are killing off wildlife and removing wildlife habitat at the insistence of buyers. This leads us to ask, can nature survive in agriculture?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 611th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Osaka who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hi.
Producer Carol Stafford.
Hello.
Parmley Taff.
Hello.
Folks, you and I love our salads, and we love our salads to be convenient. We come home from a hard day's work, pour some mixed greens into a bowl from the plastic bag in the fridge, slice up a tomato and an onion, and presto, a salad. But wait. A tiny little bug, E. coli 015787, has slipped into the nation's salad bowl, and people got sick. Some even died. Now our convenience is fraught with uncertainty. No one knows how E. coli got into the nation's salad bowl. Much speculation is focused on feedlot cattle as being the incubators, and wild animals and birds as being the vectors. But nobody knows for certain. Quite naturally, those who buy leafy greens from growers do not want to sell contaminated greens to consumers, and so are demanding that growers remove all possible sources of contamination from their fields. This means no wildlife. This also means no wildlife habitat. And so today we pause to ask, can wildlife survive agriculture? Here to help us hunt for an answer, we have Joanne Baumgardner, who is the director of Wild Farm Alliance in Watsonville, California. Joanne, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks, Michael. Nice to be here.
I think you're nice to be back, right? I think we've worked together in the past, or it certainly seems like we have. Joanne, let me ask you this. What is a wild farm? I think maybe we should define that for our friends in Osaka and Kansas and places around the world, because I'm sure when they hear about wild farms in California, they might have the wrong notion.
Well, wild farms are farms that are supporting and benefiting from wild nature. So that's everything from protecting water quality to providing habitat for beneficial insects that then help to deal with pest insects.
Okay, good. So when we're talking about wild farms, we're talking about farms that allow for wildlife and wildlife habitat, correct?
Yeah.
Good. And we always ask, who pays the way?
Oh, we're a nonprofit, and we get funding from several different foundations. We also get funding from the state to work with farmers putting in restoration projects.
Mm-hmm. Exxon Corporation donate?
Pardon me?
Just kidding. I was asking if Exxon.
Oh, Exxon. No, we haven't had to go there.
Okay, good. That's Joanne Baumgardner, and next we have with us also Scott Horsfall. Scott is the Chief Executive Officer of the California Leafy Greens Handlers Marketing Board. Boy, that's a mouthful. Do you tell is that what you tell people, Scott, when they ask you what you do?
We generally shorten it to the Leafy Greens Marketing Agreement, or LGMA.
Okay, good. Welcome to the Food Chain. Welcome back, I should say. California, what exactly is the California Leafy Greens Marketing Agreement?
Well, the marketing agreement was formed almost 2 years ago now in the aftermath of the E. coli outbreak that you referenced in your mm-hmm. opening remarks. We're a quasi-governmental organization. We work under the auspices of the Department of Food and Agriculture here in California. But we're a member-based voluntary organization. So our members are the companies who handle and ship leafy greens from the state of California.
Thus the handlers in the handlers
Correct.
Marketing agreement.
That's right.
And do they pay your way?
They do. We're an assessment-based operation. So everybody who's a member is required by law to pay into the organization according to a an assessment formula.
Good. And our next guest, of course, is Bob Martin, who's also known as Chili Bob for some reason. Bob is the general manager of Rio Farms in King City, California. Bob, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning, Michael.
Rio Farms, what do you grow there?
Oh, just about everything. All your salad items and onions, broccoli, cauliflower, celery. You know, it just goes on and on. Big list.
Well, good. Who pays your way?
Who pays our way? We do.
You actually make things and sell them, right?
We try to.
Good, yeah. Good. Well, first of all, I'd like to talk to, for those of us who really don't pay it much mind, here in California Central Coast, we have one of the truly great growing regions of the world, and we call it the salad bowl of the world. Bob, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Salinas Pajaro Valleys and why they are so significant in agriculture?
Well, we've got the Salinas Valley and the Santa Maria Valley, and there's only like four spots in the world that have our climate that is very conducive to raising salad vegetables through about 10 months of the year. So it's an area that's specific to that, and it allows for good quality, high quality products to be grown and shipped, for the nation's salad.
What is the magic in our climate that makes it possible to grow lettuce 10 months a year?
Cool nights and moderate days, and the fog and. It's just we don't get the heat from the Central Valley has. They have warm nights, which are not good for lettuce.
For greens, yeah.
Yeah.
They would bolt and go to seed, and that would be the end of that.
Yeah.
So we have here what I take to be the second most productive agricultural region in the world.
You've got it.
That's significant. Even John Steinbeck recognized that fact in East of Eden.
Yes, he did.
And so the tradition carries on today. Now, a technological development in the leafy green industry occurred, I don't know, 10 years ago now or something like that, in that we started taking our leafy greens and putting them in bags. Scott, would you address that, please? Oops, I guess I better press this button right there.
Basically summarized it correctly. That was an innovation in our industry. The bag salad was developed. Technology led to the point where you had a type of bag that would keep the product fresh and allow it to be shipped. And obviously that met consumer demands for convenience and shelf life and everything else.
Mm-hmm. And what difference did that make, that development make to you, Bob, in terms of what happened with your market?
Well, it took a lot of emphasis away from the commodity carton market situation and put it into the processing end. So,
describe that difference for those
well,
of us
I mean,
who live
it,
in those
you know,
socks.
instead of people going to the supermarket and buying a head of lettuce, now they're buying and maybe a head of red cabbage or and a bunch of carrots. They can just buy the value added or prepacked pre-cut salad with all those items in it in a salad bag, and it makes it easy for the consumer.
And thus the convenience.
Correct.
And Scott, the industry went crazy, didn't it? It just exploded.
I think that it was a product that, like I said earlier, I mean, it suited consumers' growing demand for convenience, you know, across the board. For all kinds of products, and Meta created a niche, and then that niche developed very quickly.
And so now we're doing somewhere in the neighborhood of what, $3 billion a year in business?
I don't know the exact numbers.
So somewhere in that neck of a huge business in leafy greens. So now I want to turn to Bob Martin, a general manager of Rio Farms in King City, and the reason I took interest in this story. So I saw a newspaper article about how Bob Martin was out there poisoning his ponds with copper sulfate to prevent frogs from hopping around the spinach patch. And I just thought, that is pretty strange. But when you look into it, it's just the tip of the iceberg. it seems to be just the tip of the iceberg as to what's happening. Bob Martin, did you really go out into the to your ponds and put copper sulfate in it to kill the frogs?
Well, no. This is what we do, I was kind of misquoted on that. You know how you get that way, and every now and then in magazine articles and in newspaper articles. But we do use copper sulfate, and pretty much everybody does. It's an algaecide, and what it does is it controls algae growth in your reservoirs. Mm-hmm. We've got water coming into the reservoirs, water going out of the reservoirs, and in the meantime, while it's sitting in there, it'll collect algae.
Sure.
And what algae does is it plugs up our drip tape, and so we've got to use it as an algaecide, and it also is a bactericide, and it helps. We used it extensively this year.
Use it in golf course ponds, Ryan. We're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to find out just how much the request to clean up the Salinas Valley, what impact that is having on agriculture and on wildlife. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, somehow, some way, E. coli 015787 snuck into the nation's salad bowl, the great Salinas Valley, the Pajaro Valley, and somehow it got into the leafy green food chain, sickened people across the country, and even killed some. So the industry got together and figured out how to address this situation, because it simply had to be addressed. And we're talking with people who are involved in that decision-making process. We have Bob Martin, who is the general manager of Rio Farms in King City, California. We have Scott Horsfall, the chief executive officer of the California Leafy Green Marketing Agreement. And we have Joanne Baumgartner, who is the director of Wild Farm Alliance in Watsonville, California. Scott, let's go to you. You are the, I guess, the standard bearer, the spear carrier for the industry and trying to come to grips with how to manage the situation. So how are you managing the situation?
Well, the premise of our program is that our industry needs to do everything it can to keep these pathogens out of their fields to begin with. So our program right now is totally focused on that preventative aspect. And, you know, you touched on it earlier. Nobody knows for sure, and certainly not in every case, how E. coli or other pathogens can get into these crops and into the consumer's home. So we built this program based on the premise that we've got to address all the known risk factors and try to keep them out of the fields to begin with. So we have a set of good ag practices that have been developed by industry and by food safety scientists. And our program does inspections and audits against those standards. So it's really pretty straightforward. You address water use, you address soil amendments, you address environmental impacts, you address worker behavior and hygiene, and you put specific standards in place that you can go out and measure against.
Mm-hmm. What about wildlife?
What's that?
What are the standards for wildlife?
Well, it depends. You have different categories depending on the risk level, and so you have certain animals of significant risk. Obviously, cattle are an animal of significant risk. In California, we consider wild pigs an animal of significant risk because they've been implicated in some of the outbreaks in the past. Deer are on the list, as are sheep. And then you have another layer for basically all other wildlife. I mean, if you're growing a crop and, you know, you find intrusion, you have to analyze that level of intrusion, and then you take specific steps, and maybe you have to buffer around the intrusion area. In severe cases, you may have to disc under a crop, a field.
Wow.
And but it all depends on the specific, you know, it's all about risk analysis, risk identification, risk analysis, and then mitigation.
So I see where, for example, some of your numbers are if you're going to grow next to grazing cattle, you have to have a 30-foot buffer.
Yes. And if you're next to a confined animal feeding operation, which is a larger consolidation of the animals, then it's 400 feet.
Okay, good.
So it's, you know, and those, one thing that I need to point out is that these standards are not, you know, it's a living document. It's a living standard, meaning that we are always looking for the research that will allow us to
change the rules,
change them, make them better.
Okay, good.
And so, you know, it's really important that people understand that what's in place now is not going to be the final word. We're not done, and we will make those changes as the science backs it up. But initially, you know, we had to build this based on what level of information and science we had at hand.
Okay, good. Let's go to Joanne Baumgartner, who is the director of the Wild Farm Alliance. Joanne, you seem to be taking just exactly the opposite tack of industry by recommending that we should have farms that allow for wildlife and wildlife habitat.
Well, Michael, the reason we're having a teach-in called The Misguided War on Wildlife in San Francisco on November 20th is to dispel that myth that wildlife and agriculture can't coexist, and also to make supermetrics become less draconian and more reasonable. And by supermetrics, I mean the metrics, the unscientifically based metrics that go beyond the LGMA metrics and require farmers to have sterile buffers. Some of them are up to 450 feet between crops and habitat, whereas the LGMA doesn't require any buffer between mm-hmm. crops and habitat.
Now, you talk about super metrics, which is to say guidelines beyond the guidelines being established by Scott's organization, correct? Now, who are we talking about?
Well, there's hundreds of companies that make farmers comply with their own standards. So it's all kinds of companies from buyers to mm-hmm. shippers and processors.
So probably buyers are the most sensitive to selling contaminated food, because they're the ones who have to face everybody else in the food chain, right? So they're the ones who have to...
Well, there's all... some of the super metrics are with the other groups that I mentioned. So it just depends. But... we've documented a mile of large riparian trees 100 feet wide being taken out along the Salinas River and a 20-acre lake being filled in. And this is obviously because of supermetrics, because it's not in the LGMA. The Resource Conservation District of Monterey County reported farmers were using these bare ground buffers and poisoning wildlife on over 100,000 acres. The problem with deer and the one thing we don't agree on with the LGMA is that we think deer should not be listed as animals of significant risk. There's very little research that shows that they have been a problem in just a couple of states. They've had really low levels. And here in California, we have CDFD, Department of Fish and Game, are testing deer, and they've tested over 100 so far and found none positive. So we feel like if deer could come off that list, that would really reduce the impact that even the LGMA is having. But mostly it's the super metrics that are causing havoc.
Well,
and I just wanted to add one more thing, is that removing habitat is actually counterproductive. You see, researchers show that as little as a meter of grass can filter out E. coli from a cow pie during a rain event. And it's also counter to sustainable farming practices. By law, farmers are supposed to protect water quality, and if they're organic, they're supposed to conserve biodiversity. So taking out habitat that filters pathogens and pollutants and habitat that supports beneficial insects is wrong and may cause our food to be less safe.
Okay, let's go to Bob Martin, GM of Rio Farms, the guy that's actually in the field growing the crops. What do these super metrics do to you, Bob?
Well, Michael, they go above and beyond the LGMA. Joanne's right. I agree with most of what she said right there. You look at our shelves on the wall. We've got binders and binders and binders, a whole wall full of binders of different food safety metrics and SOPs and good agricultural practice. And we've got all that stuff. And you've got one company requests or demands this. Another one will go by the LGMA metrics. And it gets extremely confusing, but
I don't really have to disagree, Michael,
with a lot of these guys. Let's name one. I mean, Fresh Express. These guys have got some pretty tough metrics out there, but they haven't had any foodborne illnesses attached to them ever since they started this program. So, how do we argue with these guys? I have a hard time with it. I mean, if you look at Michael, take a good look at what causes contamination in a crop. And granted, it's pretty well understood that it does come from the stomach of a cow.
Mm-hmm.
But once that cow drops a pile of poop, anything can attach itself to it. It can be attached, 015787 could be attached to any living creature, whether it be a pig or a deer or anything else, and then it can transfer it to your field. So this is the question. And so I'm working side by side with Dr. Robert Mandrell, Rob Atwill, out of UC Davis and Western Institute for Food Safety and Security, and with Fish and Game, Andy Gordis out of Fresno, and we're working on a program. They've been pulling just hundreds and hundreds, actually thousands.
Bob,
of samples.
Let me ask you this: we have to go to a quick break, but do you think that we're going to have to turn the Salinas Valley into a bathtub?
No, with a concrete
drain. To grow leafy greens?
I don't think it's going to be that bad, Michael, because
then hold on and tell me why it's not, because we're going to have to take a quick break. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about wildlife in the east of Eden, in the Salinas Valley. Will be able to save wildlife and agriculture and enjoy leafy green salads right back. In the leafy green fields of the nation's salad bowl, growers are killing off wildlife and removing wildlife habitat at the insistence of their buyers. This leads us to ask today, can nature survive culture? And the phone numbers today here on The Food Chain with your host, Michael Olson, 831-479-1080 or 800-624-2665. And with us today, we have Bob Martin, the GM of Rio Farms in King City, California. Scott Horsfall, the CEO of California Leafy Greens Marketing Agreement up there in Sacramento. And Joanne Baumgartner, Director of the Wild Farms Alliance in Watsonville, California. We're going to go to the phones for a quick one and talk with Roy. Roy, welcome to The Food Chain.
Yeah, thank you. I'm familiar with this problem, and it's really tragic for the wildlife, and I think there's other approaches that these people should take. I think farmers owe a lot to the public. They use the public's water.
Uh-huh.
They use.
Let me ask you this, Roy. Do you think the public owes a lot to farmers?
Of course, to eat.
Okay.
They do that. They
just
pay
wanted to make sure that
something.
We understood that too. Go ahead.
No, but we pay for that. But the farmers don't pay the public for the water or the destruction of the habitat. Over the destruction of wildlife. When this problem first arose a year or so ago, it was a killing field in the Salinas Valley. Every rabbit, every deer, every elk, every pig was open season, and the Salinas River Valley stunk of rotting carcasses. Now they're going farther to eliminate habitat. And, you know, a farm, a tilled field, is the next thing less in habitat is a paved field, because all the lizards, the frogs, the snails, mm-hmm. the creatures that lived on that land are all gone. And to understand that the source of this problem, this new problem, is grain-fed animals, and apparently, now I'm not positive, but as I understand it, a week or so of being fed something other than grain, the E. coli of this strain can't live in their body. So it sounds like what they need to do is shut down grain feeding and lettuce and vegetable growing ground. It'd be a lot easier on the wildlife, be easier on the public. It may cost some people some money, but this approach that they're doing now, I think, is a terrible insult to the environment and the wildlife that lives there.
Well, Roy, thank you so much for the comment. We really appreciate it. We're going to turn that question loose, that comment loose on our guests, and we really appreciate your calling the food chain today. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm. Well, let's start off with Scott Horsfall. Scott, what do you think about the comment that maybe we should just be feeding cattle grass instead of grains? Would that help?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know enough about that particular claim to really comment on it. I do know that there are lots of people who think there are simple solutions to this problem, but the scientists working in the field are not among them. So everybody wishes we had the easy fix or the quick kill step or the the one simple switch that we could throw that would get rid of the problem and all of these then associated problems. I do want to go back, if you don't mind, and address a couple of things that were talked about a little earlier. First of all, this is just a personal thing. I really want, if we can, to get people to stop using the term supermetrics, only because it sounds like, normal metrics are good, supermetrics must be better. And what we're trying to do...
What words should we use?
I don't know. That's sort of part of the problem. There's not an easy, pithy soundbite. We talk about above and beyond requirements requirements.
What we're talking about when we say the word supermetrics or the words supermetrics are the protocols that the growers or the buyers of growers' greens would like the growers to adopt.
Yeah,
you have offered up a way for growers to operate in this environment. You say you can grow this far away from cattle, and the supermetric people or the buyers are saying, no, that's not good enough. You have to go a mile away, and thus the term supermetrics.
Right, and again, that's not a big deal. Just a small thing. But the point I was going to make is that the other thing that along with putting this program together and doing the auditing and doing everything we can to what I talked about earlier to raise that bar for food safety as an industry, the other part of our program is the outreach, and we're going out and we're talking to buyers and we're talking to the people who are driving some of these other standards to see if we can't get them to look at what we're doing. And accept that as providing them the assurances that they need.
Okay. Well,
we're working very hard to get around that. And just one other quick point. A lot of those same companies are also ramping up their own focus on sustainability and conservation. And so it's helping lead to discussions with some of those buyer groups to make them aware that they can't have, they can't have extreme food safety standards and require their farmers to farm in a sustainable fashion because those two objectives don't always match up. It doesn't mean we can't have food, safe food and a strong environment. It just means it gives us a foundation to have that conversation with people and get them to take a little bit closer look at what they're requiring.
All right, good. Let's go to one of the growers and ask them. Bob Martin of Rio Farms, let me ask you. Caller calls in and says, hey, all we have to do is feed the cattle grass instead of grains, and we can take care of this.
Yeah, Michael, that's a theory that they have.
Has anybody tried it?
At universities where they show a major log reduction in the 0157A7 populations in the gut of a cow after 2 weeks off of grain. It's still there.
Oh, it's still there.
Oh yeah, it doesn't get rid of it. It's still there. I mean, the numbers are there, and it's not like Scott says. It's not a silver bullet that's going to cure anything.
Okay, good. Well, let me pitch that one to Joanne and see what Joanne has to say about it. Joanne, welcome back. The caller calls in and says, hey, all we have to do is start being a little more reasonable with our growing techniques. We can, for example, feed cattle grass instead of grains and tamp down the incidence of E. coli 0157H7. What do you say?
Well, I agree that we don't know enough. There is some indication with distiller's grain, the grain that is the byproduct of making ethanol. And there's so much of that around right now, and distiller's grain is increasing the incidence of E. coli in cattle. But we still don't know because that would taking cattle off grain would solve the solution, because in fact the spinach contamination 2 years ago was right next to a grass-fed beef operation. So, but we don't know if in that E. coli came directly from the cattle. It's very likely, but it could have come from pigs. It could have come in on dust or
so we're right
in
back,
on water.
We're right back at the situation where we don't have this. Really, we don't know what's going on.
Well, I do have. I did want to make a point, though, on looking at the bigger picture of our food system, in that we confine animals in these CAFOs, confine animal feeding operations, and they're perfect sites for pathogens to mutate and proliferate. And the reason why is they're in unhealthy conditions, and so they're given a lot of antibiotics. But besides that, besides trying to keep them healthy, it turns out antibiotics make animals gain weight quickly and cheaply. And so 30 to 70% of all the antibiotics used in CAFOs is going to make the animals fatter. And
hey,
when
got,
you have a lot of antibiotics, there's mutations,
yeah.
And then we have E. coli 0157 that
okay,
ends up...
great point, Joanne. We're going to have to take a quick break. White back. Do stay tuned. We're back. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. We're talking about wildlife in east of Eden, the Salinas Valley, the nation's salad bowl, the location where so much of the nation's leafy green salad fixings come from. And there's a little problem there. The little problem's a bacteria called E. coli 015787, which somehow managed to sneak into the nation's salad bowl and cause a lot of havoc down there now. And because of that havoc, the face of the Salinas Valley is changing. A lot of the wildlife is disappearing, as is the wildlife habitat. And that's the question we're putting on the table today. Can wildlife survive in the agriculture of the nation's salad bowl? We're going to take a quick phone call today. The numbers are 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080, and we have Bob on the line. Bob is a cattle farmer. Welcome aboard, Bob.
Yeah, small-scale cattle farmer. Mm-hmm. I love your show, Michael. Next time you assemble this panel, I suggest that you include somebody that has some background in raising grass-fed beef and pasturing other ruminants, just between the vegetables and the wildlife that we have for the domesticated animals. We're finding that the animals that we've had on grass for some time are remarkably more healthy than some of the animals that we buy from conventional operations mm-hmm. to convert over to grass. So I'm familiar with this experiment where they took a cow out of a feedlot and fed it grass for 2 weeks and got a reduction, but not a complete absence of the 0157. If the cow is on grass for its whole life or even a second generation, I think you're going to find.
Have you ever tested your cattle for E. coli 0157/87?
No, we haven't. We haven't had any problems with that or salmonella.
It would be interesting to test them. I mean,
yeah,
they've been on grass for a long time. It would be interesting to see.
Yeah, if somebody wants to pay for that, I'd be happy to have that done.
So let me ask you this. Do you have lettuce growers in your neighborhood?
Not close by. We're mm-hmm. more the berry farmers around, and the buyers for those farmers have looked at our operation and said no problem for the berry farmers. So, you know, that they will continue to buy their product.
Well, good.
And we have 30-foot buffers just because we're organic and they're not. So apparently that's enough.
Let's go to Bob Martin and ask if Bob has an occasion to grow lettuce around cattle farms.
Yeah, we do, Michael. And you know, the thing is, if you have to, you look at the Salinas Valley, you mentioned it earlier, is it a bathtub? It's a bowl.
Right.
You got all your vegetables growing on a valley floor.
It's shaped kind of like a bathtub.
Exactly,
but
you look at the most beneficial use of the lands above both sides of the valley, and it is cattle land, grazing land,
mm-hmm.
and you can't take that away from these people. I mean, what are you going to do with that land? It's a, and so we just need to be able to work with the interface that we realize between the vegetables and the cattle land. But there are ways of dealing with it. I mean, you put ditches up. You put things up to keep the, you know, when it rains, so you don't have...
When you think about it, though, Bob, you know, given the fact that things do roll downhill...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. it does. but like Joanne mentioned, you know, you've got those strips, and I think Rob Atwell did the science on that. I mean, a 3-foot strip took out a significant amount of bacteria when the water ran through it slowly.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree. Yeah, it does. Now it harbors pests like rodents and stuff like that. And rodents are a definite no-no in a salad bag. Okay, so we've got to realize that. And there's a lot of methods that people are using when they harvest these crops to make sure that these little critters don't get mixed into the salad bag. And we need to do more. We need to continue doing a better job of making sure that rodent parts and insects don't get into these salad bags. But it's a difficult thing to do. Most of the stuff is harvested at nighttime when it's nice and crisp and fresh. So,
mm-hmm.
And you're harvesting with a saw blade on the front of a piece of machinery, and there's all sorts of things out there that are scaring your critters away before you get there. You know, you've got a blower, you've got the little things hanging down, lights all over the machine trying to scare
it must look like a giant fire-breathing monster
exactly. Coming
through the night.
Right, and there's air gap separators that keep that'll drop out heavy particles like dirt clods and rodents and stuff like that. So, I mean, there's a lot going on, but we can still continue doing more for that.
Joanne, what more can we do?
That definitely we do need to have those salad mix harvesters develop better practices that can keep out frogs and rodents. I helped bring researchers from Cal Poly out to the Salinas Valley to look at that exact question, and he was thinking that maybe just having more people walking in front and scaring away the wildlife, because they don't have a chance. Those little ticklers right in front of the machine, which is going 5 miles an hour, a little frog does not have but a second to jump out, and if it, you know, it's just not quick enough. But compare that system with a farmer selling at farmer's market, like your sponsor is a farmer's market, and selling salad mix there. They hand harvest the salad mix, and so they can see if there's any frogs or rodents in it.
So that's a whole other way of going about life, too, when you think about it. I mean, if we're all going to live at the farmer's market, I can see this, which is what I would like to see happening, but I don't see it really working. I think we're going to need people like Bob Martin down there at Real Farms who grow a lot of salad. But the question is, does it have to be in a bag? And when we come back, I'm going to ask all three of you, can wildlife survive agriculture? Right back. But what do you think, folks? Can wildlife survive agriculture in the nation's salad bowl, the beautiful Salinas Pajaro Valleys of the California Central Coast? That's the question on the table today. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1980. Helen, welcome to the food chain. Are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Helen.
Yes. I don't know if this is an appropriate question, but I just tuned in. It's about street paving. Can I ask it or not?
No, but thanks for calling anyway, hon.
All right, bye.
All right, bye. Let's go to Laura. Laura, fire away. Are you there, Laura?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I'm Laura Judici Mills, Director of Place Safety for Mets Fresh, and we are a handler.
Good.
I've been participating in the Farm Food Safety and Conservation Network together with Joanne Baumgartner,
mm-hmm.
several organizations, including the Nature Conservancy and the Department of Fish and Game.
Well, then let me ask you this. Can agriculture and wildlife survive together?
Absolutely, and I believe that one of the keys is for the members of our network to continue to work together so that we can educate the buyers and the handlers and the growers and each other on the science as it develops or science as it exists.
Okay, good. Well, thank you so much for the call. Your telephone is breaking up a little bit, so but thank you for the comments. I'm going to go to our panel, and I'm going to ask the question, can wildlife survive agriculture in the nation's salad bowl? Scott Horsfall, Leafy Greens Marketing Agreement.
Well, yeah, absolutely it can. You know, I've always believed that, you know, farmers are environmentalists. I mean, their livelihood depends on the land and interacting with nature, and you know, as the caller just said, there's a lot to be learned. There's a lot of research being done. We're going to fine tune and improve these systems. We as the LGMA and as industry are going to be interacting with the environmental community. We already are. I think we found a lot of common ground. And you've heard some of that today. So, I absolutely believe that
Scott says yes.
Wildlife and agriculture can coexist.
Okay, good. Let's go quickly to Bob Martin. Bob is the CEO, the general manager of Rio Farms. Bob, can wildlife survive?
Absolutely, Michael. I would mention earlier that the research, there's a lot of research being done, and the data will be out soon. Hopefully some of it will be released this year. But look, it's, you know, we farm outdoors, and mm-hmm. and if you look at that, we have the cleanest food in the nation, okay, the mm-hmm. safest food in the nation and in the world, and we'll continue doing better. But the wildlife, you know, I fought for the deer's rights. I think hopefully we're going to see a lot of this stuff come back where it'll show negative on all deer fecal samples, and if it does. Scott knows I'm going to be bringing that right back because I'm a member of the technical advisory committee there at the LGMA, and I'm going to throw it right on a table and say, look, guys, okay, deer, let's get deer off this list. Let's try to get deer off the list.
Joanne Baumgartner, can wildlife survive in the agriculture of the nation's salad bowl?
Yeah, but it's not going to be if we sit back and let things proceed as they are going. The super metrics have to be reined in. They are and I know, Scott, you want us to use another term. As soon as we can come up with something better, I'll be happy to use it. But we need to stop these draconian measures from being forced on farmers. And until that happens, this problem's going to continue.
Until it happens, animals can't survive, right?
It's going to be hard on them.
Well, Scott Horsfall, Joanne Baumgartner, Bob Martin, thank you all for tuning in today. This has been The Food Chain. See you all next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on The Food Chain. MetroFarm.com. Go to the forum page and let us know what you think. Thank you all for tuning in.
Been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.